Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and later on our show, a live performance by the R&B singer and former Navy officer, Ruthie Foster. But we begin today with a few words from our very own Mayor Mike Bloomberg.
To foster our city's growth, we'll also continue to invest in the cultural facilities that make us the world's most exciting city. You tell me, what other town has 500 art galleries, 375 theater companies, 330 dance companies, 150 museums, 96 orchestras, 24 performing arts centers, and one Burmese python named Fantasia at the Brooklyn's Children's Museum?
That's Mayor Mike in his State of the City address from last week. And here to review the state of the arts of New York City is Robin Pogrebin, cultural reporter of the New York Times, and Doug Aitken, whose video project, Sleepwalkers, at, or more literally, on MoMA, is perhaps the most buzzed about art event of the year so far. To both of you, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robin, let me start with you. Bloomberg announced support for a number of arts projects, restoring the Museum of Natural History's facade on 77th Street, the New Education Museum at the Weeksville Historical Society in Bed-Stuy. But he has been a particular fan of public art and has done four different exhibits across the street from our studios in City Hall Park. Why is he such a supporter of public art as opposed to art in institutions, inside studios and galleries and whatnot?
I actually think he's both. I think what we have here, I mean, in the past there have been city administrations that have given lip service to kind of supporting the arts, and this is a man who actually has demonstrated it in his kind of private capacity as a philanthropist. He gives to the arts, and he's put public art all over the city. I mean, it's in City Hall Park, it's around and in the Tweed Courthouse, it's at Gracie Mansion. Certainly the Gates was a major takeover of the city of public art, and it was made possible by him.
The Gates being the Christo wrapping
installation
of Central Park.
Right. Yeah.
The flags.
Yeah. And at every level of the administration and all of his departments, from the Department of Cultural Affairs, the Department of Design and Construction, and the Department of City Planning, design is paramount, and you sort of feel it kind of infusing the city government. Also, we have the first kind of arts curriculum at the Department of Education. So
right.
It's clearly something he cares about. It's a priority, and it's filtering down.
Do you think it's simply a matter of his personal taste being imposed on the rest of the administration, or does he have some kind of political or cultural or fiscal rationale?
I think it's definitely both. It's certainly a personal commitment, and he believes in the value of art, but it's also, it has proven economic benefits. They say that it generates $5 billion in economic benefits in the year, in any given year in New York, at $2.2 billion in annual wages. And of the 44 million tourists who visited last year, half of them visited a cultural attraction. So I think they've really tapped into the idea that it's good business.
Okay. So it is one of the engines driving the New York City economy. And as I mentioned a moment ago, one of the most talked about public art events of the still fledgling new year is Sleepwalkers, which is placed on the wall of the Museum of Modern Art. Doug Aitken, it's his piece. Doug, we'll talk a little bit later about, you know, the specifics of the work, the musicians who took part in it, and the actors as well. But why do a piece of public art like this in the first place?
Well, I think a lot of ways this was a project which we wanted to create, which would turn the museum inside out, which would turn the buildings of Midtown inside out, and would open something up to the public. I was very interested in making a work which would empower the viewer. I wanted someone to be able to walk along 6th Avenue or 53rd or 54th Street and, you know, even just find this piece, know nothing about it, and perhaps have a relationship with it. And, you know, if they stayed for 3 seconds, 30 minutes, or 3 hours, that would be fine. But I think that's one of the things that I value about art is the idea of discovery.
And the idea that it could admit very different levels of interaction. I mean, that almost has to be in your mind when you're doing a piece of public art where people will come upon it without intending to.
Yeah, very much. And I think with this work, especially this piece that we created, it runs over two blocks, over 53rd and 54th, and down an alley that connects the two blocks. And I really wanted to make a very fragmented narrative and to let each and every viewer explore it and kind of create their own experience and synopsis out of that.
So it's actually projected onto the walls of the MoMA building in Midtown Manhattan. The timing of the piece, though, Doug, I mean, you mentioned, you know, maybe someone spends 3 seconds with it, maybe they spend 30 minutes. That's fine when it's 72 degrees and freakishly warm in January, but when it's cold, you know, people are kind of less willing to stand and take it all in after a few seconds.
Yeah, I think that was certainly considered. We found that we wanted to do it in some of the shortest days of the year. It was a bit of a trade-off, and, you know, I felt that Midtown was still very active. 5 o'clock, you know, people are leaving their jobs and coming out of restaurants. And I was interested to see if that could kind of bring in a different sort of audience than an audience that was perhaps just going to a museum to see the work.
Right. All right. Robin Pogrebin, back to the idea that is often quoted about how the art generates income for the city. How is that kind of thing calculated?
Well, I mean, I think that they talk to the Tourism Bureau and they kind of measure the dollars spent in each of these organizations. But I think what's interesting about what Doug is mentioning is that this public art is, you know, is free. I mean, basically, there's a democratizing effect that it has when someone can just walk by and experience something. And it reminds me of what Peter Gelb did at the Met with kind of projecting out onto the plaza and in Times Square. A Madame Butterfly in the fall. There's a sense of bringing it out to the people, even though it costs $20 usually to get into MoMA. Here's an opportunity to experience art in a much more direct way without having to have that hurdle.
But is there still the expectation that a piece of public art that is free to everybody will still have some kind of economic benefit to the city?
I think the idea is just to kind of, when you immerse people in it and they kind of start to experience this stuff, there'll be an appreciation, they'll seek out more, and they'll become kind of your paying customers. It's really that kind of investment in a certain value. And,
right.
And the city seems to have really bought into it. The Department of Cultural Affairs is more active than ever, and you see the Cultural Affairs Commissioner going out to all 5 boroughs, really being a presence and kind of letting the city know this matters.
Well, now, earlier this summer, MoMA announced results of a study, which I hasten to add it commissioned itself, that estimated that the museum will directly or indirectly produce $2 billion in spending and $59 million in tax revenue for New York City between fiscal years 05 and 07. How much of that is... Well, let's just be frank about it. How much of that is just propaganda? And what does it say about the kind of mixed message we send to people when a museum feels like it has to justify itself on this
kind of
basis?
Well, it's a very good question in light of all the capital projects we have going on. There's just been this incredible building boom. And all these institutions, as they get bigger and add new wings and kind of fancy new entrances, then have to worry about sustaining themselves and their operating budget. But the city has invested hugely in these building projects, and clearly there is that kind of sense that on the back end we hope they pay off. But in addition to the ones that he mentioned in his State of the City, you have a complete overhaul of the Museum of the City of New York. We have the new museum going up. You have the a new Lion House at the Bronx Zoo, a new tickets booth in Duffy Square. It's
the expansion of Lincoln Center.
Huge.
Which is well underway at this
right.
point.
And also we'll see what happens at Ground Zero. There's supposed to be a performing arts center
right,
there.
Right, right.
Eventually.
So, Doug Aitken, as an artist, you know, with the first big piece of public art up there this year. I mean, are you aware of all this backstory of, you know, the kind of expectations of economic gain for the city that on the part of MoMA and on the part of potential funders and the government? Does that enter into what you do at all at any point?
Well, the mayor was at his opening.
Well, that's not necessarily a yes or no answer.
I guess for myself, I'm focused on the work, and I'm not a man of numbers in that sense.
So, you know, the fact that MoMA is touting your piece and other bits of public art as something that has an economic benefit to the New York City economy, that doesn't play into it for you.
I would only hope that works that push the envelope of how we see contemporary art, modern living. I would only hope that they can really contribute to our society in a philosophical way.
Mm-hmm. What's the benefit of stumbling upon a work of art that you yourself did not choose to seek out?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this city is an amazing kaleidoscope. And, every day we walk out of our apartments or our homes, and we kind of walk into this kaleidoscope. And it's one of the things that keeps it vital is the unexpected.
Well, now that's the good part of the equation. But Robin, art also, provokes an emotional response from people. And, some people hate what other people consider to be great art.
It's true, but I don't think you actually get that much opposition to public art. I mean, unless it's sort of in the way of somebody's, route to work. One point that I would make, though, is we're praising the Bloomberg administration, but they haven't necessarily addressed the issue of how difficult it is for artists to live here and support themselves and have kind of housing that's affordable. And so that's another side of the equation that needs to be considered.
Well, anybody who lived here in New York City in the 1970s and rode on the subways was, whether they wanted to or not, exposed to a very peculiar form of public art. And I'm talking, of course, about graffiti. And, you'd have these, what they called the burners, the whole side of a subway car, one piece of graffiti. And some of it was extraordinary. And yet it was viewed as an eyesore, notwithstanding the fact that to this day, when you travel down the FDR, you see Keith Haring's, graffiti, crack is whack, on that handball wall in one of the playgrounds uptown, that now considered a genuine work of art. I'm simply saying that, tastes change and tastes determine what is seen as good public art and what is seen simply as an intrusion.
That's true. I mean, to some extent, we do have kind of this administration sensibility of what's worthwhile public art. They are kind of in control of what gets out there to some degree, and maybe there isn't as much kind of alternative stuff as there might be.
So is there a danger of... how much is too much? I mean, is there a danger of people having to map out their route to go from their apartment to the grocery store so they avoid that nasty bit of business that's been installed on the street corner or whatever?
Sounds like Philip K. Dick.
It does. Very kind of William Gibson-esque kind of future
there. I don't know that we're there yet. I mean, I remember these kind of electronic people walking in front of the Tweed Courthouse, which you must have passed all the time, and they don't explain what it is. It's just kind of you encounter it. And I don't think it's necessarily an obstruction on your way anywhere. But, I mean, there was a time when the Richard Serra sculpture, I think, was controversial because that was, just too big and unwieldy. And I don't think you've heard that kind of outcry lately.
We're speaking with Robin Pogrebin, the cultural reporter of the New York Times, and with the video artist Doug Aitken, whose Sleepwalkers is up and running on the walls of MoMA out on the streets of Midtown Manhattan. And, Doug, you've had experience with the way Europeans view public art. European governments, both local and on the national level, seem to have had a somewhat different take on public art. What do you see as the main differences between the American and the European models?
I'm not quite sure. I think in Europe, from what I've seen, maybe things are generated in a slightly more organic way overall. A degree of the public art that I see in the States is more from corporations or places like that.
So it has a certain institutional quality.
It's been approved in
some way at some point further up the food chain. Is that kind of the feeling you get?
It's possible. Yet there's artists like Franz Vest that are doing work, in America, Europe, everywhere. And the work is just in my eyes, fantastic public work. Mm-hmm. It's provocative, it's subversive, it's funny.
But that's what graffiti was. And, very few people saw it as such
very
back
much.
In the day.
Well, we've cleaned up New York, so they're taking a toll.
So, Robin, I guess, is there something specific to the Bloomberg administration that is setting it apart from this, either the sort of standard American model, which is kind of what's art, or the European model?
I think that there is a certain kind of sophistication to this administration about kind of cutting-edge art and openness to sort of new work. And it's not as if you're getting just a kind of a whitewashed or middle-of-the-road sensibility. You know, clearly there is a kind of a public art commission, and there are, you know, organizations that, you know, vet this stuff. And I'm sure you wouldn't see something objectionable. You wouldn't necessarily see, like, the Sensation exhibit at Brooklyn Museum out on the street. They're not going to be sort of provoking us that way. But they're certainly kind of trying to put art in your face a little bit. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what results.
Well, in a moment, we'll speak a bit more with Doug Aitken, specifically about his piece, Sleepwalkers. How do you see Doug's piece fitting into the city's public art plan?
I think it's exciting in the sense that it's just a very bold move. And it's kind of unorthodox for MoMA. And the city kind of makes very clear its support for a kind of an event like that. And they bring your attention to it. They want you to notice it, and they want it to be happening. I mean, MoMA kind of doesn't need our help that much in a way, the way some smaller organizations do. It would be nice to see kind of the Doug Aitkens of the world kind of filtering out to the borough so that people kind of sit up and take notice elsewhere. But it's still, it's saying, you know, this is a happening and everyone should pay attention.
All right, Doug, there's a garage in Richmond Hill, Queens with your name on it for next year.
Let's go.
Robin Pogrebin of the New York Times. Robin, thanks very much for being with us. Doug Aitken's not going to go far because we'll talk a bit more specifically about his piece Sleepwalkers in just a moment. And then later on, we'll have a live performance from soul singer and former Navy officer Ruthie Foster, who proves why she really is, as her album title claims, the phenomenal Ruthie Foster. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Still to come, a live performance by soul singer Ruthie Foster. But for the moment, we continue our conversation with the prize-winning video artist Doug Aitken. In the background is the Brazilian singer Seu Jorge, who plays one of the characters in Doug's video piece Sleepwalker, which is currently on view at, or more literally outside, on the walls of MoMA, as we were discussing before. Doug, Sleepwalkers features, you know, some actors. I mean, Donald Sutherland, certainly known as an actor, but the other quote-unquote actors are people like Seu Jorge, Sean Marshall, better known as Cat Power, this street drummer, is it Ryan, does he pronounce it Donahoe or Donahue or Donahoe? All right. Now, I mean, it looks like it could be the cast of a music video, but it's in fact a silent film. Mm-hmm. How does music inform this work, your work in general? Let's start with Sleepwalkers.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. Sleepwalkers, for me, the work was focused very much on this idea of the city as an energy source and a kind of piece of constantly changing rhythm. And I saw it as this kind of relationship between the individual and their environment, and how at times you fuse completely with the world around you, and other times you separate, and it's you really kind of carve out your individuality and isolation. And as you mentioned in the casting, you know, it's a wide spectrum of people from different backgrounds. And I found myself, although the piece is a silent film, I found myself attracted to people who had a certain relationship to sound and rhythm. And it was the work itself was an experiment in many ways, and I found it very fascinating to, you know, take people like Seu Jorge or Sean Marshall and strip away dialogue and really, you know, talk to them about how they're kind of feeling their surroundings, and to watch, you know, here we are in this massive postal sorting facility in Queens where there's conveyor belts moving everywhere rhythmically, and I'm looking at Sean and she's, you know, kind of gently, you know, folding this envelope, and I see her hands starting to tap on the table, and this is, you know, kind of very unique rhythm. And you know, in a moment like that, your camera just kind of glides down, starts filming that detail, and those were the things that, that some of the musicians in the work provided.
So this is going to sound like an odd question to you. Is it a silent film?
It's a silent film and a non-silent film. The city itself becomes a soundtrack. And it was something that we wanted to experiment with, this idea of creating a work which had its own pulse, its own graphic narrative, yet a bus passing down Sixth Avenue could suddenly create the background sound of a scene you're watching, mm-hmm. or just your thoughts as they're kind of daydreaming and watching images would create a narrative.
So did you get something out of having musicians as your characters that you felt there was just some indefinable something that they brought to it that you wouldn't have gotten from conventional actors?
I did feel that there was an essence, a kind of subliminal essence that was coming from them in terms of their relationship to the scenes and the locations and how they were tapping into to a kind of energy.
You know, it's funny, though, Doug, because you mentioned that, this is basically a film about the city as this almost like an organic entity and, how people as individuals relate to the larger organism of the city. And yet the way you chose to shoot the piece, Sleepwalkers, it's in New York City, but it's not views of New York City that even born and raised New Yorkers will be able to identify as New York. Were you specifically trying to be non-specific in the visual imagery?
Well, I wanted to really exercise this idea of the city. I didn't want to kind of take what was in front of me necessarily, but I want to try to explore it in a more expansive way. I want to look at the vertical city, the horizontal city. I want to go deep, deep, deep into the underground and, at the same time, film certain characters on the tops of all the skyscrapers. In fact, the studio that we're broadcasting from right now, we shot from the roof of this. Sometime on a Sunday in the summer, we climbed out one of these windows and shot the Brooklyn Bridge from here.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of created this this idea of the city as a landscape that was that I think was very open, and it was almost as if the city was a kind of the city was a mind that was just pulsing with information.
And the characters, the narrative is a very fractured one, intentionally so.
Yes.
And yet all of the characters seem to arrive at this kind of climactic, almost ecstatic moment in their lives. Sean Marshall is the postal worker. Donald Sutherland ends up tap dancing on the roof of a taxi cab. Tilda Swinton is...
In Donald's this... only silent role.
Is
ever.
That?
Yeah.
All right, well, he's old, but he's not that old that he would have been around for the first run of silent films. But Tilda Swinton is as the raging violinist, and Sean Marshall doing this kind of almost whirling dervish-like dance at the conclusion of her portion of the piece. How did you get someone who is notoriously introspective and, seems very closed in to open up like that?
I think when you do anything creative, you have to create a bridge, and a bridge of trust, a kind of shared dialogue, and you have to put something of yourself out there. And I felt incredibly fortunate with this work that the people that I came to participate in it, it was really the first choices, the first people. As I was scripting, I was thinking of Sean, as I was, developing this character who... works inside the Times Square signs, inside the lights and the LED lights and the electricity. I was thinking of George, I was very fortunate that there was a kind of direct connection. And then, but at the same time, each person, each individual character was very different from each other, mm-hmm. in terms of how they approach things.
We're speaking with the video artist Doug Aitken about his piece Sleepwalkers, which is running on MoMA. Not at, but actually on the building through February 13th. And Sean Marshall, better known as Cat Power, here's some of her latest release, The Greatest.
The greatest. No matter what I thought could stop me. And then came the rush of the flood. Stars of night. Me down. There's a big black armor.
That's some music from Shawn Marshall, better known as Cat Power, title track from her album The Greatest. She is known for these sort of down-tempo pieces, but in Sleepwalkers, the Doug Aitken video piece of public art, which is on display in Midtown Manhattan through February 13th, she turns into something quite different by the end of the story. And there is, I mean, I said before, Doug, that it's a fractured narrative, but there is a story at work here.
There is very much. I think it's a story that reinvents itself with each viewing. The piece itself, it's not linear in the sense that there's a number of different screens, a number of different characters, but only a few come on at a time, and the combinations continuously change. So it's almost a novel with different characters each time you read it.
Now, you sort of burst upon the international art scene with the Venice Biennial in 1999 with this piece, Electric Earth, where the protagonist is completely alone in a world of machines. I mean, we mentioned William Gibson before and Philip K. Dick. It was very Dickensian? I can't say that, can I? Because that's a different author.
It was taken by...
Yeah. But anyway, so he's in this kind of dystopian future and breaks out into, again, this kind of uncontrollable dance. And, I mean, was that sort of presaging some of the themes that are in this new piece?
Well, I think Electric Earth from 99 was a piece for me that really explored the idea of speed and culture and the kind of acceleration of information and our surrounding world. And perhaps in many ways, Sleepwalkers is more about a harmonization and a connection and disconnection. And one of the conversations I had, which is in a book that accompanies the show, was with this girl, Melissa. She's a cab driver in New York. And she said something that really struck me about New York and about metropolises in general. She was talking about her driving and how sometimes when she's in the taxi and she's driving down Broadway, she sees the city just as like a river, and she sees the asphalt become water and the buildings change shape and form as she's moving. And, you know, it was a very specific visual that made me think about how we kind of become what's around us. And that was something that was very pivotal for me.
Doug Aitken's work is called Sleepwalkers at MoMA through February 13th, a piece of public art that's getting a lot of attention, as it inevitably would, being in the middle of Midtown Manhattan. But you have done, you know, other work that uses music in a slightly more conventional sense, work some time ago with the band Interpol and with Andre 3000 from the band Outkast.
Yeah. I've always been fascinated by sound and how sound can kind of be seen on an equal level with visuals in contemporary art. And I've done audio works, purely audio works in the past, but also with some of the film installations, I've tried to kind of bring in people with a musical background, both to work and collaborate on the sound, but also to exist as characters. Andre 3000 was one of them several years back in a piece called Interiors. And it was very interesting kind of seeing Andre step back from this this very amplified public persona and become this kind of lone character who is walking through, you know, a few abandoned dirt fields in Compton and suddenly talking to himself. And he goes into this incredibly fast rap, like, you know, 1,000 beats per minute.
So is that why you've occasionally organized these quote-unquote happenings around some of your installations as you were doing this Friday?
Yeah, the happenings for me were something which they kind of came out of necessity. I wanted to somehow participate or to give back and to try to put something out there that was non-commercial, that was free, and it was about a discussion. And I feel like in many ways our society is so much based on entertainment, but the entertainment so often is without content. And I was interested if there could be these kind of explosions of ideas, even if they only last for a day or an afternoon or something, when it's a kind of fusion of, you know, projections and music, live music and conversations with, you know, different people that are working on the same planes.
So this Friday, February 2nd, where will the happening take place? Will it be outdoors?
The happening that's on the 2nd is at MoMA.
Right.
And you should come. And,
is it inside MoMA?
It's inside.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we'll feature Cat Power live performance.
Yeah, yeah. You'll feature Cat Power. There will be... there's a kind of musical instrument that I created. Hisham's going to be playing that with some friends. Ryan's going to be doing
You created a musical instrument?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. Does it involve video projection in some way, shape, or form?
It involves wood.
Wood.
Straight out of the earth.
Well, the happening is this Friday
at
MoMA. February 2nd, right. You're right. Week from Friday. I'm getting ahead of myself. But it is Friday, February 2nd. And Sleepwalkers by Doug Aitken is at MoMA through February 13th. Doug, a real pleasure having you here with us in the
studio.
Thank you, and
I appreciate your time and all you out there. Thank you.
All right, Doug Aitken with us on Soundcheck, and in a moment joining us for a live performance, soul singer Ruthie Foster. They say her voice, quote, can make grown men cry, unquote. She'll perform live next.
Vidas hão de amar.
Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.